bark, I'm an alcoholic.
We made it from L.A. I asked Bill Blake if he could. He said they only hold it for him on Wednesday night, so. Rob and I, we forged our way through, and my friend Rob drove me. We've been friends for, 11 and a half years. That is a miracle to have one friend for that long for me, especially when we have long periods of not needing anything from each other. He borrowed his mother's Cadillac, so he came down in style. It's not that he doesn't have his own car, he's just buying a newer one, so things get better. When I got here, I had a Vons paper bag of mismatched goods, a wired jaw because it had been broken in three places because I met a couple of lower companions, a broken nose, my shoes were broken, I was falling out of my blue jeans, and my t-shirts all had bleach stains because I tried to do the laundry once with a hangover. And that's how I came to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, which was August 20th, 1975. And I didn't come here even to cut down my drinking or drug abuse. I didn't know why I was here. And the gift of sobriety was given to me. Now, I had to work at it to stay here. But initially, I was given the gift because I ended up in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and if my mother would have sent me $20 more via Western Union, I would be dead. And I know that. So I think I was given a gift for a chance to be sober, for a chance to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to know that I had a disease and I wasn't bad, that I was sick. And I think sitting in this room tonight, we've been given the gift. If we're sober tonight in this room, we've got a gift. Now, it's up to you to work the steps to make it happen, you know, to have a good life sober. But if you're initially here and you don't know what it's all about, just take two hands, hang on to the seat for a little while, because it takes a while. It took me a while to even know I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I was at. And then it took me a while to realize I had a problem, and then it took me a while to want it. But in between all those taking a whiles, I didn't drink and I didn't use. And I don't know why. I just knew they would kick me out or something, and I had nowhere to go. I'm real grateful I got here with nothing, because if I would have had one more chance or one more out, or I would have felt a little better about myself, I would have hitchhiked and had a new life somewhere else, and I would be dead. So I'm real grateful for the chance to share at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, even if it is 3 hours out of L.A. and I haven't brushed my teeth tonight or combed my hair or seen my 3.5-year-old son or any of that stuff, you know. I'm real grateful for the chance to be able to come here because I don't want to go back. I want to keep going forward. My life in 12 and a half years, almost 12 and a half, 12 and a, 12, 8, my life has gotten considerably, consistently, and miraculously better. Not just on the outside. Because if you don't drink and you go to work and you work the steps and you have a sponsor, you get better on the outside. All that stuff happens. You begin to, you know, have a life. But the inside, I've gotten so much more each year on the inside. When I was 7 years sober, I was listening to the Cakes. I was 7 years sober, for the first time in my life, I felt from my head to my toes. I felt complete. That's why I drank. That's why I took drugs, because I felt complete. I felt enough. I was, you know, I could be buxom and rowdy and great and have a wonderful time and tell funny stories and you know, dance with Keith Burridge and all that stuff, and I just felt complete and enough. Alcohol fixed parts of me I didn't know that needed fixing. And when I discovered marijuana, LSD, Prelude and Endurance, crystal amphetamines, all of that stuff, when I went into all of that, I always had the bottle of booze. Alcohol was my number one. And I started drinking at 14. I got sober right at 26. And I was a runner. Alcohol took me to a lot of places. I was instant, you know, I had the instant courage. If I had enough going for me that on that drunk or that roll or whatever I was doing, I would pick up and leave. I remember I was living in Colorado, and I had was working in a restaurant where I felt like I fit in with the people there, and they were equestrian people, and they seemed like they were kind of a cut above, and they liked me, and they kind of took care of me, and I wasn't passing out too regularly on the you know, shuffleboard with the sawdust, and I was trying to behave myself for a little bit and staying out of the Mountain Man Bar, it was called, and hanging out in the nicer places, and I was beginning to fit in and like where I lived. I loved where I was living in Colorado. And one day this guy walked in and he looked like Bob Dylan, so I made a double order of what he ordered and came to California. And that's the way I lived my life and made my instant life decisions. Now, I was raised to have a career. I was raised to have chance. I had a lot of chances. I had a lot of opportunities. I am the only alcoholic in my family. I can't really blame it on genetics. And I never quite fit in. When I came to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I don't remember anything about it other than they tried to sell this book, and I waited for the holy water and you know, the turning over of our life forever and signing away my worldly possessions, and none of that happened. But what I heard was one thing. The man that stood at the podium said, "I always waited for the spaceship to come and land and say, 'You can come home now, Bill.'" And that's the way I always felt. I mean, I grew up in Iowa. I mean, I just didn't fit there. I just didn't fit, and I kept waiting for that spaceship. I always felt like I didn't fit anywhere, so the grass was always greener. So this guy that was coming to California looked like Bob Dylan, "I'll come." You know, the grass is always greener. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out the reason the grass was greener was he took care of his lawn. You know, you took care of it. I always wanted what you had. I was living in an organic farm up in northern Wisconsin because I was saved once again. This was, I was 21 years old. I had a non-functional gallbladder. Pancreatitis was well on the way. I had just stayed at home with my parents that winter, and alcohol wasn't the problem. The drugs were the problem. If she would just get off those drugs, she'd be okay. But drinking was totally acceptable, so that's what I did. I was very ill, and I met a new him, and he took me up to Wisconsin, and we were going to be organic together. And we were organic together, and it was really okay for a little while, but he didn't like me to drink. He just wanted me to smoke these, you know, he'd roll me packs of joints. And I would occasionally have to just go into that general store and buy 2 gallons of cheap wine and come home and have a party because I couldn't handle his Pete Seeger How to Play the Banjo records one more night with him learning to play the banjo. Couldn't do it. So I would get roaring drunk, and he would give me those disgusted looks. He'd wake up, and I'd be having the Rolling Stones on in my own party, you know, and Pete Seeger's across the room with the banjo. And he would just say, "Why can't you just smoke these? What's wrong with you? You're disgusting." And I made another life decision, you know. When it's spring and I don't need you anymore, you know. And I followed through on that. I followed through. Alcohol had become more important than people, chances, you know, potential marriage. My parents, it had become more important than me, my self-worth. Any sort of hopes or dreams I had were long crushed. I didn't know that I had no self-worth. I just always knew I felt less than, and when I drank, I felt better than, or equal to. But the better than was a real good night. But it worked for me for a long time. My family, I ended up joining a carnival from Wisconsin because I forgot the dope. I mean, that's a long story, but I was going to sell this dope I had grown, and I forgot it after I harvested it. And it was a... You know, it was embarrassing, and so I wanted out of town, and I joined a carnival, and that's what I did. And I worked my way into the South. I worked my way into jail, into Bogalusa, Louisiana, maximum security. And when I got out of there, I found New Orleans, and that's where I really drank for the next 4 years. And by this time, my father and I hadn't been speaking because my college career, I hurt him very badly when I went to college. I drug a lot of things home in his face and hurt him badly because he didn't pay enough attention to me when I was 14 or something, you know? I don't know why. I just hurt my dad a lot. So he and I hadn't spoken in years, and now my mother can't believe I'd become a carnival worker, a gypsy, and so we don't talk much. And for the next 4 years in New Orleans,
out of control. I became a sick, hopeless alcoholic. I started out as a dancer, and I ended up on Lower Decatur Street, where you pour the drinks for the guys that come up in off the boats, and they put a quarter in the jukebox, and they buy you a drink, and they'd have a drink, and then they give you a dollar, and you go dance with them, and they put their hands where they want. And that's what I had. That's my bottom. And when I tried to get hired back at that place, they didn't want me back either. I became unemployable. I'm not one of those alcoholics that look good when I drink. You know, I don't know who I was ever fooling. But I would bloat up. I would have sleeping DTs. I blacked out from 14, so blackouts were no big deal. It was just when I would lose days in a row, it would kind of scare me. I would wake up at places with people I didn't know, doing things I didn't want to do. And how do I get home? And I didn't care. I just hoped the next bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold would shut my mind off. And it wasn't, if you would have looked at me at 25 years old, you would have said that I was an old woman. You would have thought I was a street bum, because I saw myself one day. You know how you catch yourself or your reflection? I saw myself one day and I thought, who is that derelict woman? I didn't bathe. I didn't take care of myself. I had a lot of very sick relationships, and I didn't care. I didn't care. I tried to commit suicide a number of times, and once it hurt, you know, I stopped. I'd rather have a drink than hurt myself. So I'd have another drink and think about it, and then we'd pass out with a razor blade there, or we'd take too many pills, and my boyfriend would come home and be mad that I wasn't where I was supposed to be, so he'd beat me up, and I'm trying to commit suicide. It never worked, is what I'm saying. And my life was over at 25 years old. Now, my parents tried to come and help me at one point, and they saw their daughter, or what they thought was their daughter, living above a biker bar, living with a man who called me four-letter words in front of my mother, put the snake in my dad's face. This was my true love for 2 years. And when his parole got pulled and he went back to St. Louis, I should have been happy he was gone, but I followed him. Nobody's going to leave me. And I followed him up there, and I found him. And when I found Kirby that night, he took his motorcycle helmet off his head, and he crashed it through the windshield, and he pulled me out by my hair and spit in my face and said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you. And there was a policeman behind me that night, so he didn't. And I thought, okay, this relationship's over. I think I'll leave town now. And that's the way I give up. That's my best thinking. That is my best thinking. And alcohol had stopped working periodically for me. And so I would just up the drug intake or whatever was going on, hoping that it would work, because I couldn't stand me anymore. I couldn't look in the mirror. I didn't care. I couldn't stand me anymore. And in 1975, I did a lot of traveling bit by bit, and I ended up at Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood one more time. And I was going to Hawaii. I was on my way to Hawaii. I never made it. I still haven't made it. I met two guys going to Palm Springs, and it was another quicker solution, I guess, for a good time. The plane for Hawaii didn't leave for a couple days, so I went to Palm Springs on the back of a Harley through the desert that night, and I think they just needed more weight in the back. That's why they put me on, because I wasn't a good time Charlie drunk anymore. I was 170 pounds of mean alcoholic thing, slug. I wasn't even a human being. And when we got to town, we went to some nightclub, and they left me because I was being too rowdy for them. And that's when I met my lower companions that broke my jaw in three places and broke my nose and raped me. And generally, it wasn't one of my top evenings, I would have put at the top of my list. But you know what? I was talking to my friend today, and I'm so grateful. The first 3 months I was here, my mouth was wired shut. And so my ears had to open. You know, I couldn't talk. Couldn't say a word. And I was learning to listen is what happened. I'm real grateful for that, because I might have just talked my way right out of this thing. It took every bit of what it took. My past is my asset today to get me here, to surrender, to sit me down long enough, to beat me up enough so that I couldn't go stick my thumb out and try it someplace else one more time. And after I got out of intensive care, I had known a couple of things that happened to me that I didn't realize were spiritual awakenings. I was awakening. There was something going on that wasn't me. You know, when I was lying at the bottom of the cliff, in face down in the sand, that's where they had left me, out in the desert, to bleed. Something happened. Something stirred. Something said, get up, I want to live. Something woke me up. Something got me up. It was 6:30 in the morning. I should have laid at the bottom of those rocks and bled to death. But I got up and I found somebody's condominium and I had enough strength to get there. And that's when I was found and taken to the hospital. And that day, going into surgery, another thing happened inside of me. Something said to me, you know, your father didn't do this to you. The Catholic Church didn't put you on this gurney. George, who broke your heart at 18, didn't make this happen to you last night. You did this to you, Sharon. My God, that was like, you know, enough to take right there. And I heard it. I felt it. Something happened. 2 weeks later, when I got out, I was living above a liquor store in West L.A., and the guy was buying me red wine because I was on a liquid diet, and I was sticking a straw in the red wine and sticking a straw where the tooth was through the wires and sucking, and nothing was happening. There was no more comfort in alcohol, and I was just sucking on it because I didn't know what else to do. And he told me I had to leave. It was August 20th. I called my mom, and my mom said, long distance, collapse. My mother, who has always helped me, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you try the Salvation Army? And that was another spiritual awakening, because she had known something had happened to me, and she didn't know for 2 days how bad I was, and she had given me up when she found out where I was and what was going on. She had given me up. She couldn't help me anymore, and she knew it. And if my mother had said, sure, Sharon, I'll send you 20, but that's it, never call again, I'd be dead. Because the next call I made was to Chris, and Chris got me to Suzanne, and Suzanne got me to a meeting that night, and that's how I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, August 20th, 1975, not even looking for it. I just knew this guy was asking me to leave, and I had nowhere to go. That's why I believe I have been given a gift that I really respect. Because the girl, Chris, who got me to Suzanne, recognized my problem. She was a friend of mine from Barney's Beanery. She was the first time I had seen a big book was under her arm. She was drunk with her friend, calling a taxi cab to leave this bar to go to an A&A meeting. What do I know about A&A? Nothing, you know. We just cheered her out the door with our doubles, you know. Chris recognized alcoholism. Chris got me to my first meeting. Chris is dead today. Chris died of alcoholism. Chris was younger than me. She was prettier than me. She was more talented than me. And she had several attempts at dry outs and hospitals and programs. And she never got it. The last time I saw her, she was in a wheelchair, she was bloated, and she looked 45 or 50 years old. And she died, lumpy and old. I don't know why I'm here and why she's not. It's not me, it's not for me to know. What's for me to know is what I do with the 12 steps today. What I do with my life today. I am 100% responsible for that. Step one. 99% responsibility does not work for me. I am an alcoholic. 100% I do not drink no matter what. Period. If I want to get to step 2, 3, 4, 5, I got to take one completely. When I drink, it controls me. There is no turning back on that one. That's been proven. That's been proven by the people I watch go back out, and if they're lucky, they come back in. And I ask them, how was it? They never say better. They never do. And I like to look in their eyes and see if there's anybody home anymore, because there's usually not. There's usually not for a while. So I know that alcohol controls me, so that I know that I am an alcoholic. And number one, that's number one on my priority list. Every day, no matter what else comes down, I don't drink no matter what. Because if I do, there's nothing else after that. I have no life. I know that. Inside my heart, inside my gut, it took me a long time to accept that. Step one, but I believe it firmly today, and I re-believe it, and I retake that step every day. Every time I'm at a meeting, I retake that step. And I fell into a group called the Pacific Group, and they took care of me. They gave me a sleeping bag. They moved me out of the liquor store. I had no choice. They just moved me onto a floor here and moved me onto a floor there, and they gave me a big book, and they hired some jerk, I think, with a Texas accent. I think he goes around meetings, pokes you in the chest, and makes you get a sponsor because you don't want him to touch you anymore. You finally get a sponsor because this guy just makes you nuts. And that's why I got a sponsor, is because I didn't want Michael poking me in the chest anymore. And I learned a lesson, because once I got a sponsor, my life got a little bit better, because I was sharing it. I was cutting my problems right in half with somebody. I learned a lesson without knowing it. I learned motives didn't count. I learned it doesn't matter what you think, it matters what you do. And that is something I live by today, because if I listened to my head before I got out of bed, I'd have the brain tumor and be dead already, and the funeral planned and be somewhere else. I don't listen to my head. I put my feet on the floor and I go. I am not wonderful in the morning. still am not. My son wakes up happy in the morning. Maybe he doesn't have to be an alcoholic. I don't know. You know, wakes up with a smile. It's nice to see. My life got interesting. It got better. I woke up. I had 3 months of sobriety. I thought this guy told me just to take my pack off for a little while because I looked tired. I thought he was smart, you know. God, I don't know how he knew I looked tired. I didn't know how they all knew I was new when I came to my first couple of meetings, you know. And they raised my hand. You take the 20 questions, and they give you a book, and they're happy you're there, and they give you all this attention. And they said, don't drink or use no matter what between meetings, and we'll see you tomorrow night, kid. You know, my mouth was wired, so it didn't matter what I think. I couldn't say it. And I'm still with that same group today. And it's my home. I have a home base of people that I know, people that I've seen, of friends like Rob, and friends here like Bill and Orville, and people that I see every week. You know, I see Jerry. I see a lot of people. It's wonderful. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have such a wonderful network because where do you know? You can. I go out in the world. I work in a high-rise today. I work with grown-ups, their attorneys. You know, they don't know anything about me other than I show up and do a great job. Because that's my program. I try to do my best. And usually I have to give them at least 150% to feel even. That's the way I still am. But I walk in and they say, good morning, Sharon, how are you? And I say, I'm fine. Thank you, how are you? I don't say, but I'm an alcoholic and I had all these emotions and I'm working through this. And only if they leave me alone and I need more money. And you know. They don't have to know a thing about me. I've learned how to act. I can come at the meeting and I can tell you, but I'm an alcoholic and I can go through it all here. And you understand. God, that was the first thing that attracted me, was you understood. I've been to psychiatrists. My dad had sent me to priests. I had been, you know, to the Krishnas. I have been a lot of places. And nobody understood me, and I knew it. And when I came here, I couldn't say that anymore. You understood. You were reading my mail from the podium. You were telling the secrets I told Mary Kroll at 8 years old, and Mary Kroll never spoke to me again, you know? You were saying them publicly from the podium, and I knew you knew. I just knew you knew, and I respected that. My life got better. I got the wires off. I got employed. I started to work. I learned to show up no matter what. I had one of those mean sponsors. If you didn't show up, she'd slam the phone down on you, and then she'd piss you off, and you go out, and you do everything she said that day, so you can call her at 5 o'clock and say you were wrong. I've never had to call a sponsor back and say you were wrong. If I had been willing to follow the direction, if I had been willing to let somebody else's judgment work over mine, it's always been a good day. Because between me and my sponsor is air. My sponsor can see a lot more clearly to me than I can to me, because between me and me are all my emotions. You know, that says it. All the 12 people that live in my head that have to talk about everything I decide. Sponsors work for me. They still work today. I need a sponsor today as much or more than when I first got here. So I listened to my sponsor, and I showed up on time, and I did a good job, and my tips got better because I learned how to give an Al-Anon smile. I mean, they taught me how to do this, and fake it till you feel it, because I thought, oh, this is AA, and you got to be honest. And I go out there, and I tell people how I was, you know, and they didn't care, and they didn't want to hear it. They just wanted their coffee and their breakfast, you know. And I would go on these interviews. I interviewed for a better job, and they would ask me about my past, and I'd tell them everything, you know, and they would just, like, be fascinated. You know, real grilling interviews. I never got those jobs, you know. The less I say, the better on those type of situations. But my life got better. I got emotionally involved because he was kind to me and he was nice to me and he was had 6 months more sobriety than me and we were about the same age and he had tattoos and, you know, and it was like, it felt kind of rebellious, you know, in your first year. And we got married after 2 years of sobriety and my dad came to the wedding, and my mom came to the wedding, and my dad walked me down the aisle, and he said to me before he walked me down, he said, you know, Sharon, if you ever think of what you were doing before, why don't you think twice? You've got it made here. And finally, my dad gave me some approval. Finally, I got that. But you know what? In those 2 years of being sober and working the steps, I had some of my own. So it was a little icing on the cake. It didn't make the sun come up. And that was a nice feeling. About 5 years of sobriety, I went to New Orleans, and I got to make amends to a lot of the people there in the town. And my it was really a high for me because I got to visit a lot of my old haunts, and I got to make amends to old bosses. And I got to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous in the French Quarter. And three of those people are sober today. About six of them are dead, but three of them are sober. And just the example of Alcoholics Anonymous in that town was something else. And I got to go to Montreal for the International Convention. I've got to do a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a travel agent and found out I hated flying sober, and I had to take these tours to Mexico. And I was crazy. I was like, you know, I didn't wear any sort of polyester when I flew or nylons because it would stick to you and you burned, so you only wore cotton clothing. I would have my life in order before I got on the plane, and I was nuts. I was crazed, and all these people were drinking, and I had my briefcase and my suit, and I was just crazy, and I told my sponsor about it. She said, you know, Sharon, you can have fear or faith. There's not room for both in your heart, so pick one. So I thought, okay, I'll pick faith. So, I mean, that's all I would chant was faith, not fear, faith, not fear. And my God had... Well, my first guy was Beacon's moving van because they said pick anything. It drove by and it wasn't me, so I picked it. You know, made sense at the time. It still makes sense today because I'll be real uptight driving along and there will go Beacon's. Oh, it's going to be all right. You know, still works. But I had to get a different concept going about them. Beacon's wasn't enough to take on the plane with me, you know. And so I became trusting. And I had faith. It took me a long time to trust God. I had faith first, faith for a long time before the trust came. And it happened. It started to happen. I started to make some amends. It's funny how these sponsors pick up on things like, well, what step are you working in? Let's work on this. And I started making amends, and one of the biggest ones was to my father. Because I had made the written amends, and I had lived my life, you know, well, and included them occasionally, and sent Christmas presents, and, you know, but they still lived 2,000 miles away, so it was easy. But she said to me, do you owe him any money? And I thought, oh, how does she know these things, owe him any money? Well, yeah, I think it was a little bit. So she said, well, call him and ask him. Ask him how much and tell him that you're going to send him a check every month and you're going to make this amends to him. So I thought, okay, I'll call him and Dad will say, forget it. It's been too long, Sharon. Wrong. Wrong. We agreed upon an amount. And I started to send him a check, and she said, oh, and by the way, with the check, include a note about your life. What's going on? Just a friendly note every month. So I did that, and I sent it along. And I don't know, we're into year three now of this payment schedule, and I'm starting to go a little nuts. And I said, God, Ginny, I mean, I think I'm past in on I owe him now, and he's not paying attention. Can I call him and ask him how much more? And she'd say, just send it. Send the check and send the note. Maybe he's putting it into a trust fund for you, or he's going to buy you that Jaguar you always wanted. Just send it. So my dad didn't know why I sent it, but I would send him the check and the note. And then one of the holiday seasons, it was right after Christmas, he called and he said, Merry Christmas. You don't have to send any more checks, but don't stop sending the notes. And something happened inside me. Something healed. Something moved me ahead with my life. I got rid of a big piece of a big rock. The steps work. They've worked continually for me, if you work them. It says a lot through the book, faith without works is dead. You know, you can have all the faith in the world, but you got to do it. You know, you have to come to a meeting. I have to come to a meeting. I have to work the steps. I have to give it away in order to stay here, and I know that about me. And it's a joy to do that most of the time now. My God, I have wonderful motives now sometimes, and that was frightening when I started to want to do things. Then I would judge my good motive. You know how we never are satisfied. It's just, oh, screw it, do it. And somewhere along 5-6 years of sobriety, I began to grow up a little bit. My husband at the time started to become a teenager or something. He got into psychedelic music, and then he discovered the punk era. And we were like black hat, white hat in this house. It was he started to go to flotation tanks and less meetings, and more punk rock concerts and less meetings. And I'm speaking and sponsoring people, and it was like two strangers. I had to go to Al-Anon. That's what happened. And I had to learn to release him. I didn't, you know, I would put that Dead Kennedys record in the oven and turn it on and think, well, I'm going to have to tell somebody about this. So I turn off the oven and take the record back out, you know. I mean, I tried to fit in. We used to go to Cramps concerts, and I would wear my Midol shirt, you know, and try to spike up my hair and fit in. And you know, what happened was he went through that, and I went through what I had to go through, and we ended up hiking together a lot. We said, well, our sponsor said, what do you do best together? What do you like? Oh, we like to backpack. So we went backpacking. And we got rained in Rattlesnake Creek for 4 days, just a torrential rain in the High Sierras. And we had to survive in this tent because we couldn't let things get wet. So we spent all day surviving. That's what you do. You just talked and survived. And we became friends again. And we worked through a lot of stuff again. And I got pregnant, and nobody knew I could do that. And 9 months later, Wesley was born. And Rob was there. Rob helped me breathe. I had to teach him, when I was in it, how to breathe. So it was quite an experience. I had a lot of people there loving me. And they walked in once, said, do you want something for pain? And I said, not right now, and they never came back. Okay. And he's a gift because I took hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD. And he's got all his fingers and all his toes, and he's perfect. He's God's kid, and he's a gift. And that's another miracle in my life. Because I didn't know I wanted to do that. I didn't know I wanted to be a mother and a housewife. Jesus. You know, I followed my sister's a Mensa. My younger sister wanted to be a nurse, is a nurse in Alaska. My younger brother carries a family name, is successful. And Jesus, what was I? The alcoholic? No, I'm the only alcoholic, the only divorcee. I've never been to Europe, and I'm the only non-college graduate. I add a little life to that family. What can I tell you, you know? I just went back for my brother's wedding in Wisconsin, and out of the whole family, he picked me to read. And I was really touched by that. I am so glad my parents don't have to lie awake at night and wonder where I am or if I'm alive anymore. I got real happy for a while being a mother and a housewife, and then my husband decided to leave. And I told you how people leave me, right? Not very easily. But it's not very dignified to hang on his leg and talk to a newcomer on the phone at the same time as he's deciding to leave. So, I don't know, my image won or something, and I had to let him go. And he did leave, and he decided he wanted a divorce. And I was, like, thrown into this shock because I marry forever. I don't know about you, but I'm loyal to a fault once I'm loyal. And it was real hard to walk through. I came down here and shared, I think, in the middle of that. And I spent a lot of time crying from the podium, and it was hard to get through my talk, and people just loved me in AA no matter where I went. And I got to speak a lot, and I didn't have to be around my home group to speak, you know, around that area, because nobody got custody of the meeting, see. He was still coming to the meeting, and I was still coming to the meeting, and nobody was speaking to one another, and it was a painful situation. And you know, then there was another woman involved, and then I didn't know what to do. I wanted to throw hot coffee on all of them, and I just got crazy. And about this time, Clancy became my sponsor because I went to pick up my other sponsor at the airport. She'd been in Paris for a year, and when I went to pick her up, she was supposed to have 21 years, and she had 21 days. So I did the next thing, which was I called Clancy because I had been calling him on a weekly basis, and I wanted somebody that was out there in the trenches with me, somebody that's active in Alcoholics Anonymous and giving it away. And he took me aside one night because I had that wild dog look in my eyes, I think, and I had my arms around the coffee urn or something. I'm going to get up in the night. And he looked me square in the eyes and he said, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others, Sharon. I thought, this example shit again. Yeah. But I heard him. He got through to me. And I did. I didn't throw anybody's hot coffee. I gave up the spare keys to his car I had a set of keys to my ex's car, and I wanted to just drive it right up to the beach, you know, right down there by the ocean. But I didn't. I gave up the keys, and I started to walk through it with dignity and grace and put my eyes back on me because, you know, when you judge, one finger's out there and three fingers are back at you. You know, I had to start looking at me and looking at my life. And I didn't get wonderful and spiritual overnight, let me tell you. I mean, I was a crazed woman running to meetings, running to work. I went back to work in the entertainment industry where they didn't know if you were nuts because you were coming off a coke or if you were going through a divorce. Everybody was crazy there, so I fit right in and nobody could tell, you know. It was okay. I cried all the time and they didn't know. And I was loved back to life. I didn't run. I'm a runner. I am a runner. I pick up at the drop of the hat when I hurt a little bit. I don't know how to sit through feelings. When you have a feeling, let's make it better, let's make it worse. I didn't know you could hang on and sit through one and it goes away. And I did that for a year. I walked through it. But I did join the softball team that played her softball team. That's what I did. I did do that. And she's a lefty and she hits a right field all the time. And guess who played second base? It felt really good to lie in the dirt and grab those balls, I'll tell you. Yeah, it made the team better. Nobody knew why I was out there. Made the team better. I tried harder. And I worked through it, and this last Christmas, we exchanged Christmas presents. Him and my ex-husband and his girlfriend and me. I didn't know that was going to happen. You know, I had no idea. I had no idea I'd want my life as it is, exactly as it is today when I was going through that pain. I had no idea. That's the trust. I had to start having a little bit of trust in God that what was going on was supposed to be going on. And if I'm standing in the middle of this quagmire and standing in the middle of this swamp, I've just trenched through a half a mile. I got another half a mile to go. I want to know why I went through the first half a mile, so I'm going to keep going to the next island. I'm not going to walk back to the beginning and have to start all over again, get thrown back in the swamp. I don't change easily. I'm not one that wakes up in the morning and goes, I think I'll change my character defect, anger. Yeah, that's right. Let me work on anger today. I don't do that. I have to be forced to the wall to look at me to change. And that's also why I love working with others, because you get to see and you hear what you say and you have to follow your own advice, because you got to walk like you talk, because I respect me today and I want to respect me tomorrow. It means a lot to me to have a lot of self-worth. I was the type of person when I first got sober, I walked into your store, I'd have $2 in my pocket, I would spend it because I'm breathing your air. I tipped gas station attendants back in the days when full service was it. That's how my self-worth was. I had none. And today I can walk into a room, head up, eyes clear, walk up, say hello, introduce myself, shake their hands, and feel a part of life. Feel like one of God's kids. I deserve to be here. And that's a wonderful feeling. Alcohol and drugs didn't even give me that. Sobriety and working the 12 steps has given me that. I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of working these steps. I didn't sit in a room with my big book and it came over me. It just didn't happen for me that way. I had to get out there and be ground out there and go work life. I don't care how you feel, kid, you go do it. And I went and I did it, and I would come to the meetings at night and I would get refueled and I could go back out there and do it again. And after a while, my life got better. After a while, I began to like myself. After a while, I began to fit in. After a while, I knew I belonged here. You know, I was always a big answer searcher. Where's the answer? I mean, I found it on 16 hits of Orange Sunshine one night, playing Satanic Majesty's Request, a bottle of wine in one hand. I was all alone, and I found truth. It was there, right there in that cut. I found it. It happened. That's the way I was, looking for truth, and it was always so elusive. It would just, you know how you pick up sand, and you grab it tight, and it goes right through your fingers? There's nothing left, you know? I don't wear my sobriety that way. I wear it, as they say, like a loose garment, you know? I've got to learn to be flexible. I am flexible. I've got certain things I do to stay sober that I know I have to do to stay sober. I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of my God every day. And my God loves me and I love my God. I go for a walk with my son. He wakes up happy in the mornings. He comes and he tickles my cheek. We wake up and I put him in this baby jogger and we go out for a 1.7-mile walk in the morning. And we look at the fat birds and we look at the cats. And he always says to me, even if it's overcast or hazy, it's a nice day today, Mom, isn't it? You know, and he's just such a joy to be able to have that gift in my life and to be able to go off to a grown-up job and carry my briefcase and fake them out every day, you know? It's wonderful. They pay me to do this. I can't believe it. Have some goals in my life. I've got some goals for me, some short-term goals just for me that I know I can accomplish. And my life is really full. I am very, very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am very, very busy involved with people, and I like it that way. I don't think I have much else to say. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.